ask a question, because we should be leaving soon, such a flight. So I have left meeting and we will pose that question to Sarah. Can you get a question?
Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks for the question. The question is to Sarah. I think the department, keeps on hiring incompetent people. For example, sometimes the people that are hired to do work at the department, you would find that sometimes people that teach biblical studies, poetry farming, and they hold high top position. And for those people to be competent, it's very problematic. For example, there is a lot of competent personnel that the country has lost, the government has lost to industry and consultants that were trained with public fees, government money, that were skilled overseas, and unfortunately, due to that, the working environment that are not conducive, they tend to resign. And who benefits in the process is industry getting well-skilled professionals as well as consultants, of which is problematic. I think government should really also look into that as well. Quality staff is key for the country, more especially the issue at hand. People who are competent, not comradeship and designing of non-existent posts, because we have seen it in some municipalities. Recruitment processes should be qualified, quality, competent personnel that will understand their role, for example, be able to look at the raw data and also be able to analyze the raw data to a layman of the street. Also looking at the issue of municipalities. Most municipalities, unfortunately, they are located. They do not know what they are doing because they are incompetent personnel that are on position or post and they are unable to fulfill their duties. And I do believe that South Africa, there is still less we can learn from developed countries in terms of ensuring that we skill our people. Chair, on the issue of the licensing, for example, I see the presentation from SAGA says there's a backlog of close to 60%. And this is so scary because I feel if they were competent personnel, we wouldn't have such huge percentage of backlog. I believe that there are people who are hired to do such work, for example, licensing, and those people are unskilled and they are incompetent and they just take the work for the duties and they just shelve it because they know that they cannot do it. Secondly, on big industries, if you look at the shared travel payment, Section 21, big industries such as Starcraft engine, Sasol and so forth. There's a thing that is called paid listed activities. And if they take a listed activity, there is a lot of money under the Section 24, under the Section 21 industry, that money can be used to skill people that are doing that work. And hopefully not lose them to consultants or industry. When it comes to the procurement issue, my former chair raised it, and it was a discussion that was discussed. I think that's another critical issue that we also need to look at. If we need to be like China, be copycat, so be it, because the issue of procurement is a big problem, whereby we have such big and expensive, sophisticated equipment which are supposed to capture information data, and we have found when industries exceed the limit, or there's an accident, or there's an explosion or a fire, they do not capture data because there was no equipment. It was not functional because they're still waiting for equipment from wherever, from Germany or whatever the case may be. And that equipment has been purchased in the last 3 months, and it hasn't been received. And industries get away with murder in that process because they only do their own monitoring, of which they are not entitled to give to government at some stage. And obviously, communities are also not receiving that data. So these are issues that really we should really scrutinize and zoom in as to how do we look at the issue of procurement and ensuring that equipment is sourced locally, as the Honourable has alluded on that as well. So I would like to end on that as well. Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Motivate from the age to
those cards, make those appointments. To do that, we have to go through the regulatory regime from COFTA, the National Treasury Board, so I've got some of the information. I also alluded to the issue of time turnover. So in the cases where we do get competent people, turnover becomes, it's a revolving door. For example, very few engineers or people with PhDs or whatever would want to go and look in pop artists, for example. So sometimes the environment in and of itself detrimental to our capabilities. Because in some areas, it just, we can't compete in those areas. So we, most people want to live in urban areas and so on. So that's one factor. Lastly, another important factor, I think, is the whole issue of, are we able as local government to offer competitive service in terms of the industry? And I guess this touches again. And remember, I'm repeating my presentation. But this touches on whether we are able to afford getting the correct qualified people and why we are seeing exodus of qualified people. Bear in mind that engineers, for example, most engineers in the local government space until about 15 years ago were about 50, were white, and they basically. So we need a new, a new group, a good blend of engineers to enter the system. And that's why we need to work with academia and the various entities, etc. And we do have some projects. For example, we've got a project that's funded by the UN under the Climate Technology Center, where we're looking at how to have learnership in 11 different municipalities. When we're looking at environmental engineers, environmental scientists, and deploying those people from FEC colleges to municipalities, and trying to create a place in the structure to actually retain them. So it's a long discussion that we can have offline. Safe to say that, as I also indicated, only about 1% of municipal budgets is available for environmental performance. We want to influence the municipality's growth. That's currently, municipal performance is cost-subsidized from revenue that's generated from the clean water industry. And it doesn't sit at the top in terms of prioritization. So it gets whatever is left over after they've now finally allocated to cemeteries and whatever, and then environmental performance allocation. And that is about how we improve prioritization within the municipal sphere. How we make environmental management be of equal import as water services, public roads, and so on. And that's what we work heavily in. And that's why you have a councillor that was here who now runs a portfolio on environmental issues, so that they make the necessary arguments and help on how to progress the resource environmental sector. And then in closing, I just wanted to mention that we also need to figure out a way of building the confidence of the private sector in local government. And statements sometimes that we make don't build that confidence in our government, because maybe local government is part of the broader government. And language that we use sometimes often works against us in terms of attracting the privacy. Getting people who are leaving academia to want to work in local government is sometimes worked on against because of the kind of repression and racism. There are instances where it is many instances where local government is working, but well resourced and fully functional units. So we as Falco want to create a network where municipalities can learn off of one another, but also are exposed to the practice from the region and from the rest of the world.
Okay. Thank you. Can we get a presentation from the Falco? Is now ready for you to present. I think next time the final discussion will put it before the graveyard session. Not graveyard session, but I trust that colleagues and guests are ready to engage. They are rejuvenated after lunch. See, that this is a very quiet talk. Okay, thank you very much for the floor.
And then in blue, I highlighted it to just remind us that only those things that you estimate will be on the pie chart. And while that seems quite trite, the point is that if you're not able to estimate some sources, then those that you can estimate look more important. So those that you have good data on, those that do report, you'll have good emission estimates for them. Things that you can't get data might not even be on there, such as waste grade, in some cases dust. And it depends. Different HMPs and different projects have trouble quantifying some sources more than others. We now talked quite a bit about emissions, and inventories are very important and very useful from a management perspective to identify gain sources. They're also identified up there, but of course they're what underlie and are the input into any air quality modeling. But of course they don't replace what people breathe. That would be the ambient air pollution. Now I won't talk about this too much just because we've already talked through it. I did draw a little person here. He wasn't part of the schematic that I took. So this is reminding me of ground-based sources that generally people are, when they're close to them, such as traffic and vehicles, will be impacted quite strongly. More high-level sources that can impact higher up in the atmosphere and can also come down and impact the ambient and the air that we breathe. And the impact of pollution are also shown on here. We talked a lot about how, not as much about ecosystem from my deposition, and I'll show some of that. Agriculture is an area we've been starting to work in more, understanding the impact there. That's from both ozone and SO2. It can impact water, materials, visibility, and we did hear also about climate. I do not include indoor air pollution here, and I'm really not going to talk about that. It obviously has a very large potential health impact from domestic fuel use in particular, but I'll focus on the ambient in this talk. So just a little historical measures, a little perspective. SO2 and smoke, or PM10, were measured from the CSIR starting in the 1950s, and some of the first measurements were in Shawnee. And I'm sorry for the poor quality of the figures, taken from quite an old scan, quite an old article, but these are PM10 concentrations. This, in the middle of the scale, they're saying this is 100 micrograms per meter cubed. You can see here. These are Victorian bloom paint sites. And they did say, this was an article in the Clean Air Journal in 1980, that from the measurements, they did see a decrease in PM10 and SO2 in the scrap up to 1980. However, the first time I saw these, I did not live in Victoria in 1950. So these are winter averages of over 100 micrograms per meter cubed. Currently, our annual standard is 40 micrograms per meter cubed. And they define winter as April to September. And so what we're trying to do is we are trying to digitize these data to give also a perspective of where we've come from, of how polluted that was. Compliance monitoring is now the source of most of the routine air quality data. We've heard a lot about SAPWIC. And so the routine regulatory ambient monitoring now is with the government and with the South African Weather Service. And this type of monitoring doesn't sit within CSIR. We have seen RIPA did show, some groundwork did show some of these, so I'll go quite quickly. These are just from the State of the Air report showing the largest exceedances of PM10. This is in the high fault priority area. And SO2, not as many, but there still are some. These are not unusual or unique. Many places we have worked have particulate matter and ozone exceedances in particular. And both of these have a secondary component. Well, PM has a secondary component. As Rico had mentioned, it can be emitted directly, but it can also be formed in the atmosphere for SO2 or NOx. And other, and we have also organic carbon as well. So you can't just regulate one thing and impact PM. It has a lot of sources. And the same with ozone, and I'll get to that a little bit later, that's quite complex, as it's only formed in the environment. From volatile organic carbon compounds and NOx reacts. And it's highlighted still very similar things. This is the fall, PM2.5. We see a lot of exceedances. One of the things to highlight when we look at these is that there are varying levels of data completeness across the year. And I'll show in a few slides what exactly impact that can have. And then also to remember when we're looking at these, we generally do talk about the priority areas or urban areas. Because monitoring sites get placed for a reason, and they're generally placed in the most polluted region. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the whole country is experiencing that air pollution. I mean, of course, many of the people live in the industrial and urban areas, and they get exposed to it. But there also is a need to understand the background concentrations, or the regional aspect of this. As Rico has also shown from some of their work, the particularly secondary pollutants, such as PM, it can travel for up to a week, and so it can travel long distances. So what I'm highlighting here at the bottom, because I'm sorry it's so small, is PM, ooh, even small to my eye, slightly due to that. There really isn't much around this background type. So this is helpful also to understand the different sources of the air pollution. I did say also I talk about exceedances, and when we think about the trends and when we think about how many, what the average concentration is, we also need to think about that as a student. What I have here is two different years. This is 2011, ozone at one site. This is 2014, ozone at one site. And just because it's small, let me get the numbers exactly. This one, if you just did the annual average, sorry, the top, if you just did the annual average, you'd say it's 21 parts per billion. If you did the annual average down here, it was 25 parts per billion. And if you just report that without thinking about that in completeness, we say, oh, well, this year is better than this year. But can we really say that? We can't, of course, because most of the year is actually missing, right? And then there's some kind of questionable looking data there. And this is something that, of course, happens at monitoring stations, particularly, I think, in the beginning when learning about maintenance and how to keep them going, that there are gaps in that. And believe this, there always will be, even in a perfectly functioning network. Hopefully, you'll never. So this can sort of make trend analysis difficult. And it also shows that the same support for the compliance monitoring is key. We won't know where we're going, we won't know where we are if you only have a third of the year of data. And this shows one just a case example of the city of Johannesburg. And I'm showing the city just because we have done this analysis, we've done this work. It's a little confusing, but I'll talk you through. The number of ozone exceedances is over on the left-hand side, and that's what the dots represent. So if you look at 2004, right, you look at the blue dot, which stands for Buccleuch, which is in the key at the top, you can see it didn't have many exceedances. However, the blue line tells you what fraction of data were there. So that gets to all the way to the right, and that's about 0.2, or 20%. So it really also does count in some way that they didn't have exceedances, because 80% of their data was missing. And as it fluctuates, as you go across the years, and again, I'm not pointing out to the Johannesburg because they're unique, this is quite common. The number of exceedances, you know, when you have more data, do hold more validity. The analysis that we did also with this is show that the ozone production in these sites are VOC limited. And what that is the two precursors, as I mentioned before, are NOx and VOC. And that's because those are the levers that you have to decrease ozone. They're the two precursors. But in a VOC limited regime, if you only decrease NOx emissions, which you want to do also because it's a criteria pollutant, you'll actually increase ozone before you decrease it. Because that is not the thing that at that point is controlling ozone. You actually need to decrease both of them together. Some trend research that I picked up from the Northwest University are some of the long-term deposition, the wet deposition measurements. They did a paper that looked at four different sites. And I'm sorry, the site is cut off in this, but I think on the printout it should be there. They looked at four sites and compared the data records from the 80s to the 90s, from 2009 to 2014, looking at wet deposition or rainwater. And they saw an increase in wet deposition flux of species associated with anthropogenic activities. And it's quite small here, but three of these studies, Sakuya, Amos, Sport, and Louis Trutarch, are quite regional background sites. Only one, the Vol, is really influenced by anthropogenic right in the middle of the Vol triangle. So even our regional and our regional sites are having an increasing wet deposition and also an increasing in acidity in the rain effect. This is not going in the correct direction to improve the wet deposition. This is another paper done by a South African group, the trend in ozone. The analysis was trying to understand if the El Nino Southern Oscillation, or the ENSO, impacted ozone concentrations in the high belt. Now we had El Nino, remember, 2015, 2016, and at least those of us in the northern parts of the country remember the drought. El Nino doesn't always have drier conditions, it's typically it does, and typically it's warmer. And so then we would think we would have more ozone production under those. And for four of the five stations that they studied, the stations are listed up here, Milan, Contain, Kendall, Hope, Vertical, the American accent, Homer and Makalu. Only the last one didn't show sensitivity to ENSO in December and May. They also looked for an annual trend in ozone, which are these data down here, and they couldn't see a trend in ozone with data from 1990 to 2007. And they did
one station a slight negative trend, 0.92 decrease per year in the spring, and that was the only one that was statistically significant at a monthly station. So very little change, very little trend at the time. This is a quick analysis that we did to get ready and to show that we thought we have some more trend analysis. What we have here are the different stations. I'm sorry, you can't see Beecliff, Ermelo, Ingina, Sableton, Milberg, Cliff Revere, Secunda, Sharpville, Three Rivers, Sandella, and Bifong. From 2008 to 2015, so from both the ball and the high cells, PM2.5. And we took monthly values and see if we could find the trend through those monthly values. With this, we did apply an 80% status maintenance rule. So I have scratched out those that did not show the statistically significant decreasing trend. All of the others did show statistically significant decreasing trends. I've highlighted what the trends were from -0.6 to -4.5 micrograms per year. We still, I put this as preliminary, we still of course have that there isn't continuous data across, but by doing this on monthly, we do have quite a lot of data points. I also estimated, I didn't put it on here, but using those linear trend poles, and depending on the site, you look at the 2015 value that was in the state of the air for PM2.5, the range of how long it would take these sites to commit to comply would be between 1 and 12 years if they continue on this. And the ones that were 1 are the ones that are almost there already. We also need to continue to assess the data and trends, and I think I have to go home and do this to all of the students that I have data for right now. So we've also looked at international databases. Because long-term records of data, while there is compliance monitoring, particularly in the priority areas and other metros that started earlier on, a lot of places just have started getting data in the last 2 years. So there isn't quite enough data to do a robust trend on. So while the data from the Waterbirds and the Cloud sites, there is a published article about that, but there's only 3 years of data, which really isn't enough time to get a trend. So we just look at international products available for air quality. These include emissions and global model outputs, and we have assessed the quality of input data for the Environmental Performance Indicator, the EPI. And this is part of a project for the Chief Policy Advisor, DEA, Strategic Environmental Intelligence, Mr. Peter Leakey. And what we wanted to look at was both SO2 and PM2.5. So for SO2, we do not have a comprehensive SO2 inventory to compare to the EPI. However, with the NICE system that is now being populated, this will be possible soon for industrial sources. However, industrial sources are only part of the puzzle. In order to compare and to improve these types of databases, we also need non-industrial emission inventory. So for SO2, things like vehicles, domestic burning ships are very important. What they showed here, this is the SO2 emission from 1860 until 2000. So you can see quite a large increase. Then what I did is I also looked at these winter concentrations of SO2 from 1960 to 1980. They reported them as SO2 and they recorded them in micrograms per meter cubed. We're more used to thinking of it in ppbs. This is where the annual average currently stands. So we can see there still are quite high levels of SO2 during the time when our emissions were quite low compared to where they are now. So if we try to change this a little bit and look at different factors, we once again have the emissions in SO2 from different databases on the bottom. We see those are increasing. If we look at SO2 for GDP, we see it kind of constant, and then in 2000 it actually starts to decrease. So while the SO2 emissions were increasing, the SO2 for GDP started to decrease. And the same a little bit with the per capita, though that has been much more slight of a trend, it's kind of plateaued. So the decoupling of SO2 emissions and GDP growth would be quite positive. However, remember, these are all international databases, and it's very hard to tell how robust these trends are until we can make certain. The first time I looked at this, I said, well, but what is missing? What don't they account for? What emission sources don't they know about? So we really need the local data to feed into this to see if this is true, if we do have decreased SO2 for GDP. And of course, we talk about improvements in air quality, but what is important is also to consider the counterfactual scenario. What would have happened if without air quality management? And if emissions were continuing, would air quality have been even worse than it is now? To try to understand the impact that we are having. And so this modeling is a key aspect, because we're only living in one scenario. What these data are not the exact same data in both burden of disease, but are very similar. And what we looked at in the high cell and in the vault, we used those because of the PM2.5 from 2010 till 2013. The blue are the annual, or the 3-year running median value for the station. That's measured. The red is international database. Our measurement is about 3 times that of the international database. This is all published in the Clean Air Journal. And what that means is, while I said this is not exactly the global burden of disease, we actually also put that information in our article. Because already the global burden of disease has impact on air quality is bad. And this is actually saying, well, it's a lot worse. And I would actually not be surprised if this wasn't true for many places in Africa. When looking at Africa, atmospheric science, generally when we get measurements, it actually quite worse because the emission sources are grossly underestimated. And so what we need from this is really local emissions for local researchers to feed into these studies and then continuous ambient monitoring to validate when these come out. So we can validate in other areas as well. So that's for the science for now, since I was given this trend in air quality and I am a scientist. I wanted to put in a couple slides of the trends in research and what we think we need to improve air quality. And of course, continuous compliance monitoring is very important, but so are targeted campaigns. Targeted campaigns that monitor more than just the criteria pollutants and the things that we need to understand, the things that can react, also to form them. Improvements, the alignment and availability of emission inventory from all sources. Nice is a big step forward. We still need a big step forward like that in the non-industrial emission sources. And also to assess the use of the international databases. There's a lot of information out there, and a lot of this get published, and we see trends, and we see what is climate change and going to do to air quality, but it's not really validated. But it doesn't also necessarily mean that it's bad. So we really do need an assessment of what can we use and how can we improve this. And it also goes to be used to satellite data. What can we use it for? I didn't talk about health just because that was a part of this, but working in a group that works on health, of as groundwork is pointed out, sometimes the very most vulnerable. And now they're also being impacted by low-level sources. And of course, these are much harder to manage. Everybody can go and find where the FCOM stack is. Tracking down the car that you see polluting objects is much more difficult. And then the last thing of the management trend to highlight is ozone. I forget who showed it, but it was a large number of ozone cadences. This is a similar graph that I showed before, but this time it's for the high cells. Once again, it wouldn't be completely different if we showed other places. The number of cadences, you can't barely see it. This is how many you're supposed to have. All of the dots, this goes up to the hundreds. All of the dots of how many cadences there are. These lines now are the data routines, which you can see for quite a while, which is quite good. And so ozone is a really difficult pollutant to manage, and I'll show that on the next slide. And this is also an area where I had listed those research needs for emission, understanding the precursors and monitoring them, and modeling. Ozone has climate, it has health, it has agricultural impact, and it has benefits, and has benefits to mitigate it. And one of the things is that we do simulate those concentrations in our model, and very often they're too low. We don't really know why, because we don't have enough measurements to compare it to. And so that also, we do need specific measurements in order to improve our simulation of it. And just also show, I think the really from DEA had mentioned about this, but this is from the US EPA. This is looking at the SO2 average from the country from 1980 to 2016. The one on the bottom left-hand is SO2. You can see from the 1980s, it starts decreasing, but it kind of decreases. PM2.5 is at the top, starting in 2000. It doesn't decrease as quickly as SO2, but it does. And then ozone starts from 1980, and it kind of hangs out, and it very, 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 very slowly decreases. And I thought that was interesting, because it really shows the struggle, that ozone is difficult, and that you need really sustained, targeted, and effective management to deal with ozone. Ozone is hard, it's hard everywhere. In Europe, they're also struggling with this. And again, it's because there's so many different things can impact it, it's not emitted directly. And so for this, we do need the evidence base. What is the modeling, and the monitoring as well as the impact of ozone. So just to conclude, this is my last slide. I put that top point there to remind myself to end positively. As a scientist, of course, we always want to point out the gaps, we always want to point out the uncertainties and the assumptions and the issues. But I do feel that South Africa does have the tools to improve air pollution, and they are improving. Even I moved to South Africa in 2010, and even across that time, I've seen the number of graduates, the number of people, the monitoring data, all of this has been improving. The map of some of Africa that we have here is an international assessment on the air quality management across Africa. And only South Africa is in this dark orange color, so it's considered comprehensive. But of course, improving air quality is difficult, and you can see with the trends that there are striking trends quite yet, but some of them do show a decrease. And it is an ongoing process that needs continuous effort. As we discussed, with capacity, it does require technical knowledge, sustained support. I also always wonder if air quality is difficult because it's invisible. At the mine drainage, you can see the yellow color, you can see things. Other than black snow, you don't always see air quality. But there are real benefits. It is a complex solution from the diversity of sources, and in my mind, the monitoring must not just be monitoring, but also modeling, to consider that counterfactual. What would have happened if we didn't do this? What would have happened if an offset didn't happen? Traffic could be increasing and pollution could be getting worse while your management effort is still working. And so we have to compare that. We all do still want to decrease ambient, but it helps to tease out what's causing it. And then, of course, the research community at Big Power and also the community across the country can assist in providing the evidence base for effective decision making. With that, thank you very much.
All the three inputs, and then put system and
mention this because as it becomes clear, we have described the stages of our consciousness as they could. If we look at the stages of criteria precisely, where must we place these monitors? How many should there be in relation to things like population, in relation to industries or sources of evolution, and in relation to the severity of evolution in a particular area? And the site selection criteria are specific to each pollutant. So it's different for ozone, for example, against particulate matter, PM10 or PM2.5, and maybe different for SO2, NO2 or NOx, CO, benzene, and so on. And then recognize the different methods of monitoring as well. So, in a nutshell, proper air quality monitoring says that the system must produce good, acceptable, quality data. Now, we've seen the question of data gaps come into it, but the figures that are recorded, have they been subjected to proper quality assurance procedures and so on? That's the question that has to be addressed and that needs to be mentioned. Secondly, the spatial distribution, the distribution of monitoring stations and of the pollutants monitored, should take cognizance of those factors which I mentioned, population distribution and so forth, industries or sources. And then there should be a system for proper management of the data and public accessibility of the data. So all those things are important, and when we ask the question of what is the status of our monitoring network, it must be against all those criteria. So if we go to the SACS website, which is the main site through which we access the data and all the information, we get the following map, and all those dots which I can see sort of light blue throughout the country. It looks not too bad. We've got many monitoring stations in the heavily industrialized areas and in the major cities, Cape Town, Etobicoke, and so on. And even scattering of monitoring stations in smaller towns. So from that perspective, from the point of view, this is another monitoring station that looks like not a bad monitoring network. And the questions are, what's the quality of the data? And then those questions, what procedures are used and so on, and is the information accessible? So if you go into the SACS website, you see that there's actually a whole lot, a large number of data providers. So that network doesn't represent a network managed by a single entity, but by a whole number of different data providers. In the major metropolitan areas, the cities, Johannesburg, and so on, Cape Town. And then there's a private network, PUHA, the DEA, DEA itself, manages the network, and then a number of private network managers. ESCOM, that's all of the largest, but there are also some smaller ones. So there are 27 in all listed on the website. And my questions are, how many are in fact still missing data? Certainly the quality of the data, and are the monitoring stations functioning in a uniform way to a common set of norms and standards as required by the Air Quality Act? If they're not, then they can't really be regarded as part of a single national network. So I then looked at the question of accessibility of the data. What is actually available on the website? Not just the location and the name of the monitoring station, but what data is being produced. And generally, I looked at the period from the beginning of last year, June 2016, to the end of July. I didn't know. And here's another site, also a SAFOR site, Funda site. And here, again, you've got data, and but here you see a couple of data gaps, which show my point of view. Early in the field, because it's a result of not only emissions directly from soil, refugees from a vehicle failed by it, but it's also a secondary pollutant. It's formed as a result of SO2 and NOx reacting in the atmosphere and forms these small particles. So it's a combination it reflects a combination of different sources. And the other part of it is that it's the pollutant that carries the greatest health risk of all of them. So if you're not monitoring and looking at the impact of PM2.5, you are missing out a big part of the picture in relation to the relation between air pollution and health impact. And we have to monitor PM2.5. Now, in 2016, I requested all available PM2.5 and or PM10 data from all the monitoring stations on the list that have been given to me. That's about 90 stations appear at this stage. The City of Cape Town are not submitting data. I requested separately, names separately from the City of Cape Town. That made the list over 100. Station listed as existing. Of them, only 36, roughly one third, provided usable data, either PM10 or PM2.5. And of the 36, only 21 satisfied this criterion of data recovery. In other words, in any 1 year, you should collect at least 80% of the value over that period. Otherwise, we couldn't tell you whether or not the annual average, the average for that year, is a representative number or not. As Professor Garland pointed out, if you have a big gap in there, we really don't know what the average was. And so only 20% satisfied quality criterion. And only 11 of the 100 plus actually monitored PM2.5. So about 10% actually monitored PM2.5. Since 2012, there are two or three more stations that monitor PM2.5. That still leaves us a very low percentage in terms of PM2.5. And generally, the network, even when one considers all the other pollutants, only about a third actually seem to be collecting and reporting data. So are these things improving? The fact is, I don't know. Because when you look at a few monitoring stations in those areas, things seem to be improving or not improving. I must say that when I looked at the priority area monitoring stations between 2012 and 2015, I couldn't detect a significant improvement. We don't know because we don't have access to accurate and credible information and certainly not comprehensive information. What is the destination? My question is, where are we going to? Are things actually improving? Are we going to comply with the provisions of the Air Quality Act and the framework, not just in terms of some sort of monitoring, but in terms of a systematic attempt to monitor air quality in relation to the sources, populations, and so on, all the criteria set out in the Air Quality Act. And the question is, what is the solution? I quite frankly don't see how 27 data providers can be knitted together and the next prior
Carmen Hugo. I'm an attorney and I'm the head of the Pollution and Climate Change Program at the Centre for Environment for Us. So we're a group of activist lawyers who help communities and civil society organizations realize our constitutional rights to a healthy environment. And we do that by advocating and investigating for environmental justice. As Rico said, we, together with Groundwork and Earth Rights Africa Johannesburg, form the Life of the Coal campaign. And what we aim to do there is to accelerate the retirement of our existing coal infrastructure, to encourage and enable a just transition to renewable energy systems, and to discourage investment in new coal-fired power stations. So my topic is rather broad, but I'm going to use the example of the high coal forest area to address it. Now, this area was declared in November 2007. You can see it's quite a large area. It includes big towns, Emalashin, Littleburg, Secunda, Sanderson, Edenvale, Boxburg, Benoni. It's really one of our industrial highlands in the high coal. So 12, including Cecilia, are excellent coal-fired power stations are there, as well as several Secunda refineries and many hundreds of mines, primarily coal, other facilities, Columbus, Sanders, Samantha, Ferrocone, Ceremonial, etc. So what happened is that there were many demands by civil society to intervene to address the quite serious air pollution in Mpumalanga High Coal. And in November 2007, so just about 10 years ago, was declared our second priority area after the World Triangle. At the time, the department said people living and working in this area don't enjoy air quality that's not harmful to their health and well-being. In other words, people's constitutional rights in terms of Section 34 are being violated. Just over 4 years later, an air quality management plan was published with the main aim for all ambient air in the HPA to comply with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. I think we all know these are the standards that are set under APRA, that ambient air has to meet for people to breathe that air without damaging their health. So there were specific objectives that committed the department, the two implicated provinces, and the relevant municipalities to start tackling those air quality problems. And all of the air quality management plans should be reviewed after 5 years. So in addition to that main aim, which is to make sure that our ambient air quality meets the standards, there's seven additional goals which help to address that overall objective. You can see one is 2015, which is 2 years ago, and the rest are 2020. So the first one is capacity that we've talked quite a lot about today. And that says organizational capacity is optimized so that we can efficiently and effectively maintain, monitor, and enforce compliance to ambient air quality standards. By 2020, industrial emissions must be reduced, as well as dust fallout in the valley, so that we can meet the ambient air quality standards. Air quality must be in full compliance. Domestic air quality must be in full compliance. Then we've got goals there about vehicles, awareness, environment, burning, and waste emissions. So, just a bit about our background and our participation in the process. The Centre, Groundwork, and the High Coal Environmental Justice Network, we've been supportive, active, and very vocal participants in the various HDA processes for many years. And we focused those efforts in Mpangala, the district municipality. So that's home to MRJ, Middleburg, Delma, Indrina, and it hosts significant industrial electricity, mining, manufacturing activities. We've been frustrated with the lack of progress and the very, very devastating health impacts that follow from it. policy findings, crucially, air quality in a high health priority area remains poor, outcome findings in health based and in air quality standards, despite the fact that it's now a year since the HPA was effective. The DA's own midterm review of the air quality management plan confirms this. So emissions have not decreased significantly, if at all, over this period. So we've seen some evidence of potentially decreasing trends, but that doesn't affect the huge number of teams that still occur continually. We say that this continued non-compliance with these standards is likely in large part due to the failure of major industrial facilities not decreasing their emissions adequately or at all. And this is exacerbated by the National Air Quality Office's decision in early 2015 to grant those MES bonuses we've been talking about to the two biggest polluters in the HPA, so that's Eskom and Sasol. So we said all of those factors have made it much more difficult for air pollution in the HPA to be reduced. You've seen this slide now three times. That's the EA's latest report to exceed in the three-year period there. In the high health priority area that was presented in May 2016. So those are all huge, everything in red means going over the standard with significant health impacts. Similarly, those show some of the trends. The red line is the current standard for PM10 and PM2.5 I put up there. And those are the years of IPA1 inflation, not particularly years to get on the So remember the capacity there, the goal was by 2015 that we optimize capacity so we can monitor and enforce compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. There we found that neither Tangala nor the local municipalities, and this has been confirmed by everything we've heard today, have enough money, they don't have enough dedicated, appropriately trained, skilled staff to implement the air quality management plan and to enforce that. So they only have a few of the right people to do the air quality management work, but these officials are moonlighting in many cases. They have too many responsibilities, they're overstretched, so they can't devote adequate time that they need to manage air quality and to do compliance and enforcement. So Ntangala only has three officials to do compliance monitoring and enforcement, many hundreds of facilities under their control. And these municipal officials have actually done very few compliance inspections of polluting facilities. Also, several of the municipalities in the high health priority area don't have the air quality officers and the air quality management plan that have worked at the time. So this is just a summary of the Ntangala municipality and the local municipality that's also in the HPA. This is from Ntangala presenter and ICP meeting that just shows the three, I'm not a bit corrupt, I think, so, shows us three designated EMIs in Ntangala. So, as Eugene said, so that is the finding of capacity. Air quality monitoring. We don't actually have a sufficiently credible method to monitor, track, and report emissions in the HPA. And unless we have adequately functioning accredited monitoring stations, we don't know if the air quality actually works in those years. In fact, the monitoring metric has deteriorated since the declaration of the HPA. So in 2012, when the air quality management plan was published, there were 23 monitoring sites with available data. And in the DEA's midterm review, there were only 9 monitoring stations with data. And of those, only 5 published timely and monthly reports available on track. Then we get to access. In fact, it's difficult to assess directly whether key found that negligible measures of impact in 10 years to reduce that, including bylaws, some compliance inspections when they dust complaints. But the dust control regulations have proved very inadequate for this purpose. And the DMR, responsible for regulating design environmental impact, including air quality, doesn't participate in the HDA process. We've heard quite a lot about indoor air pollution. We found that very limited steps have actually been taken to reduce air pollution. So there's a draft strategy, which was published in July 2016, but there are no adequate, measurable, and progressive plans to try and address this very, very difficult challenge. Nor is there proper provision for CEOs and NGOs in its design, implementation, review, and update. And in fact, we don't know when the final strategy will be adopted and implemented. So, what do all these findings mean? Well, really, the HDA has been a failure so far. Hasn't improved air quality so that it meets the national ambient air quality standards. So on a daily basis, people living in the HDA are having a constitutional right to an environment not harmful to their health and well-being violated. People are dying prematurely. They're suffering from respiratory and cardiac illnesses. And Rick has talked about this report of Dr. Mike Collins. I'd like you all to, on your hard copy, change my second bullet there. I'm afraid we made a mistake. Should be 50 billion, not 30 trillion. That's still extremely huge of energy, just from Exxon's cost of power station emissions. And by the way, that doesn't look at impacts such as those from mining and transport and coal, contaminating water, blasting. You see in these reports these tables represented in. And the disaggregation to per station, so Medusa was found to be the most dangerous in terms of death. What we've also done is, looking at all of these concerns, we've tried to make some quite practical suggestions. People living in the HDA and organizations that have participated in these structures are frustrated by government failures by reducing air pollution in priority areas. Also, as I say, we're not adequately monitoring air pollution, and pollutants are already not being held accountable. So we've set up what we see as some minimum measures that have to be followed to meet Section 24 of the Constitution. And we say these are steps that must be urgently taken by the authorities to demonstrate that improving air quality in the HDA and in the other priority areas is in fact a priority. So, just looking at the continued non-compliance of the ambient air quality standards, it's clear that immediate steps have to be taken to reduce emissions of pollutants. So, we say that all the HDA facilities have to at least comply with the minimum emissions standards. Ideally, of course, because they're in a priority area, they should be meeting stricter limits in their emission levels. And this is the question I asked earlier. So the Section 21 list of activities says that if after the National Air Quality Office has granted this bonus, non-compliance with ambient air quality standards remain, she can hear representations from the facilities and the affected community and use her power to withdraw the NES for the bonus, and we say that she should. Not only that, there's no further postponement of NES nor other variations that allow exceedances of emission standards should be allowed. In fact, licensing authorities shouldn't be issuing any new AELs in the HDA unless and until we get consistent compliance with the ambient air quality standards. This also means that where industries want to expand, that approval of any of those plans has to depend on them simultaneously substantially reducing their emissions. What's more, when facilities reach their scheduled end of life, and there are especially certain Exxon coal-fired power stations, ALs should be withdrawn, those are the atmospheric emission licenses, and decommissioning and rehabilitation must be addressed. Also, on the similar point on emissions, we say the dust control regulations have to be amended, and we've been engaging with the EA on that for a while. They have our specific suggestions.
Thank you very much for the trained presenters. We are now much more invited to engage on the issues. So I'm going to open up for panel comments, questions, suggestions. I see colleagues, guests are quite satisfied with all the input that we Now, there's something that worried me in the second presentation. There was a suggestion made. Or let me just say, the presentation suggested that the monetary stations are failing. It's only 10% of all of them. Monitors or data on the most deadly content, according to what was said here. Now, that is very worrying, very worrying, if that is the case, including some of the monitoring stations which are located in areas where you wouldn't expect that they should not be functioning because they are in sort of well-to-do and qualitative areas. Can we have a comment on that and just get someone just to unpack this issue there? See, I'll raise my hand.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think there were quite a few things that kind of jumped out at me between those three presentations, and they kind of all interlinked in some way or another. The summary, though, was shown by Robin in her presentation on the exceedances. The snapshot of exceedances on the standards presented by the DEA themselves, that to me is indicative of exceedances of health standards that are protective of health on single occasions, and they could be very, very high. The peaks can be very high. When we look at the averages, when we look at the average data, these are smooth over the period of a year and over the period of many years. But this slide here tells me a very different story. And the story behind this slide is something that I think we need to unpack. Because unless you have regulators who are aware of this happening in real time and are acting in partnership with health authorities, only then can we be sure that we are going to put out messages to the public in a way that we can begin to protect them. Never mind that over a long period they are exposed to what are called chronic. I think I would like to hear a comment from all the presenters on what this actually means. You know, what does it mean to the questions that they were answering? I think that's an interesting question. Thank you.
The other worrying thing which came out of the presentation of the Center for Environmental Health is that 10 years down the line, there has not been any improvement in the priority areas which have reflected in the priority areas. Now the question is, what is the purpose of declaring an area and priority area if there is no priority attention given to that? And I think unless there is a dispute with regard to the information and data that was used, but basically nothing significant has come out of that declaration. And I would like the department just to comment on that. Because the other question also that arose when we met with the department. what is the regularity of the meeting town often does meet, because one would assume that when we declare an area priority area, the group can put an effort to make sure that it's compliant. In that case, there is a significant reduction. So I hope you are taking down the questions that you are asking.
I want to put the question in such a manner that it does not necessarily put any of those groups in interest against a particular institution or department or government. But in a manner that both would want to comment on it. Let's follow on the last one which we have just said. Part of the allegation I think is that the departments do not show any serious demonstration that air quality is the priority in their agenda. From where I'm sitting, I'm not sure if the department will want to talk about the issue without a situation where you contending around us and using the forum that the chair is referring to would serve as a purpose of where you engage upon the situation. But also you went further to say that there is no much demonstration by the department to enforce the norms and the standards, commission standards that are there by way of sustaining licenses definitely. And I thought that in the transition period there will be ways in which things are done, and so on, to the extent that you arrive at suspension. And where you're sitting probably you think the department may not be serious enough. We had a difficult job. I know oversight of the portfolio committee to fast forward ESCOM and so on. And I'm not arguing that the stations that have been highlighted here have been reporting at those particular periods or not. I'm not entering that space. And I'm saying we would find the impact that the industry presenting their own data to the extent that they then say in terms of the standards they are within compliance in terms of some of these particular meta or whatever emissions that are done. My question chair is the department has still said they are not able to approaching green particular in terms of the ambient pollution that is there. So the extent that you can then say on this particular one is plus on percent. And this is the extent to which the polluters and so on and so on. And that is one of the difficulties in terms of industry to account. Now, in the other studies by either Groundwork, Dr. Mike Holland, or any other person who has entered the space and done some studies, are you in a position to approach the kind of blame to a particular industry or source and say, not just ambient broadly to say there are particular industries which are operating there and therefore they pollute it. And then have a blanket approach to how they should take responsibility. But the issue is, are we able to tie down, to tie a particular industry and say, you are the major pollutant and therefore around that area and so on. But that thing that has always been arguing that air emissions are high up there as opposed to the indoor kind of the either through cleaning or any other emission which affect the health of them. So I'm just thinking that that could be unpacked there so that we'll get to understand what could be used to understand how can go out of the forest, let some breakthrough in that kind of the challenge that we have.
Okay. So let's say,
thank you, Chair. I'm partly covered on a number of issues there. I'm looking forward to the department's response because they're something that they obviously have to respond to, and there are a number of questions and concerns put to them. But I find it extremely disturbing these figures, these facts on the health impacts. I mean, really, the really disturbing figures. Without going into detail, and they've been repeated in the groundworks presentation and in the last presentation we had by the Centre of Environmental Rights. But the question is, I just want clarity on these deaths. Madupi 364, Matimba, so Madupi stands out. But what concerns me is that's one of the newest stations. Now, we heard about the plan being accepted in 2006 before. I'd just like a little bit more detail on when those deaths occurred. Unless I'm missing something, I can't find a time period for those particular deaths. And specifically with Madupi being one of the newer parts.
Okay. All right, let's get a comment. Should we start the presenters and then get to the start?
Visitor says, I'm not sure if there's actually a question, so there's a question of concern about the monitoring network. So I want to comment further on this. I can comment on the question of, there are different sources of pollutant, or particular pollutants, and when you see an exceedance, the one says it's not me, it's someone else. Basically, I think the honourable members comment a question there. Now, I've got two responses to that. The air quality management plans were published in HPA, in the case of the HPA in 2012. It included quite an extensive document, almost 200 pages. So it included an analysis of all the sources in the area, from power generation, from industries, from households, fuel burning, and so on. So that was step number one. Number two was the modeling, which related these sources to ambient concentrations. And number three, it's clear. All right, if I just look at one particular source, let us say you had fuel burning, what does it look like? I put all others at zero and just look at that particular source. I take the power station emissions and do that alone and so on. So these sorts of portions, and it showed which areas and by to what extent the ground level of ambient concentration were being caused by which source. So you have the information there. It's based on the fact that what you read is related to the source. Now, for example, we've heard a lot about emissions from domestic fuel burning, coal, and wood, any wood. Now, the total emissions of particulates from that source is about 5 or 6% compared to all the other sources and so on. When it comes to the sulfur dioxide, industrial sources and power is 99% or 98%. So there's absolutely no question that emissions to zero, we're still left with a 95%. And then the next question is, well, what are you going to do about that? Now, I just want to mention in one part that that's a graph of hydrogen sulfide emissions from the Secunda site, that of the Secunda site. Now, that process is the only source of hydrogen sulfide in that area. In fact, in the whole world, you won't find another source of that magnitude of hydrogen sulfide. So when you measure hydrogen sulfide, which is what the graph shows you, it cannot be coming from anywhere else. You know, so in some cases, it's absolutely no question. In other cases, there's other information that shows the relationship between one source and the other.
Clearly the current compliance and enforcement efforts, as far as we can tell, are not
for ground level sources, though, that still can have larger impacts, not just the people who are living in those areas. There is evidence that even domestic fuel burning, the aerosols from domestic fuel burning are transported quite great distances. Particles can live in the atmosphere for up to a week. And so I think just using emissions only to say, well, this is who is impacting ambient the most, is not, you still need to take the emissions to ambient. And as I said in my slide, particularly for emissions, the things that are in the pie chart are the things, the emissions that are in that pie chart of who is emitting what, are those that you have data for generally, and those that are considered. And some of the more low-lying ones, such as traffic and such, have notoriously been very difficult to estimate. And so I would say things like industry, we generally have a better idea of what they are emitting, particularly now that they have to report. And so that piece of the pie we understand better, but we don't always understand its proportions without understanding all of the sources. And to start to get to who actually is causing the majority of the pollution, as Eugene stated in the AQMP, they just start that with some modeling. But that's actually, we do have the expertise within the country to do that. But that's a rather large study. You need monitoring. You also need the modeling and tracing particular industries or particular facilities, which we can do. And then also need the monitoring data then to compare it to. For example, if you don't consider all the emission sources, you won't be modeling reality, and you'll only be modeling what you put in. If you only put in one source, that is the source that is going to contribute to ambient. And I would just like to ask the last representative from CER of the data that you have that shows that domestic fuel burning is decreasing. The only data I've seen that shows that is due to census. From the census, we know that data is quite flawed. They have changed questions, and they also only ask what is your primary fuel use. And so there has been a large decrease that we see in there. However, some also reports from the HSRC do show that most people use many different fuels for different sorts, for different activities, and also during the time of the month. Sometimes you run out of money by the end of the month. So I don't think we can discount domestic fuel and its impact, particularly on the health.
Okay. You want to respond?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to respond to the Honourable Member's query about the duty debt. The duty debt, the details around that are debts attributable to the duty for every year. And these are what are called attributable debts. And the way they determine attributable debts is looking at the sum of factors related to the emissions from that plant that make up this equation for attributable debt. So we can begin to disaggregate the data, not just looking at all the emissions, the cumulative emissions, but breaking down the emissions per power station. We can begin, the methodology allows you the opportunity to disaggregate the data. So you can look at it plant by plant. But mainly it's driven by the emissions that are coming from each individual plant.
Okay, I'm sorry, there's a hand at the back.
Good afternoon, Sajin. Satana Kinzi from Sakyate. I would just like to make a comment on Professor's presentation, particularly on Kairicha. If you look at the period, 2016 to 2017. There was no PM10 data, that's correct. But the fact that there is no PM10 data doesn't mean that the station was not operational. If you look at Kairicha is a multi-parameter station. So it measures PM10 and a few other parameters. And I think this points to another issue and another concern, let's say, or another challenge that municipalities has. If we look at Kairicha, if a particular instrument goes down, we don't have the luxury of replacing that instrument with a scale instrument. So we often faced with situations where a particular instrument goes in for repair, and because of the various ECM processes, it takes a very long time for that instrument to go back into the field. this term deeper. But the point here is that just because there's no PMK doesn't mean that that particular station is not operational. So, thank you.
Okay. What then the issue is operational? Measure all the supposed to measure. And of course, maybe probably that's what available at that point. Maybe we should get this pattern to install the standard in the way forward.
Honorable Chair and everybody else, I think it is quite evident by now that ambient air quality monitoring is a challenge. And by all accounts, it comes with the terrain of ambient monitoring that you definitely have kept. And we have accepted and contributed to that at the beginning of our engagement today. That we have experienced in the past and still continue to now experience very big attacks for a number of reasons. I've articulated issues pertaining to power supply, health, and so forth. So we were the first to admit and present to our stakeholders the challenges that we face pertaining to this area. But I've also indicated, Honourable Chair, that there are plans in place to address those particular issues. So I hope everybody will take comfort in the fact that the department is committed in ensuring that we continue to monitor ambient air quality, specifically in the areas where we know that we have a possible impact, if I can mention the priority areas. And so we are committing moving forward that this issue will be addressed. And also to add that with the surface upgrade that is currently underway, we hope that there will be improvement in the management of themselves, but also in reporting, that we aspire for real-time reporting, and that when this is launched in the next couple of months, we will be able to move a step closer to realizing that goal. And also to indicate to everybody present that the government is committed in ensuring that we continue to execute the function of ambient monitoring. So I hope with those few ways, everybody gets the comfort that it is not a responsibility that we are neglecting, it is a responsibility that we take seriously, and we hope that in the next coming months we will be able to report to you that we have made progress. The next one, I guess, is totally linked to that in terms of the experience, what we see. And Rico's question is, I'm not getting 100%. Our client and response, that what we are interested in is really to boil down into the details of the data, what it tells. Now, what you normally see are averages over a period of a year. There you can see that over that whole year, what was the average? In reality, is that there are times when the standard is exceeded and there are times when it's exceeded. And so, what we have done by actually putting that slide, it was not a slide that was there previously, something that internally we discussed. And we felt that it is not only good for us to know, but also for our stakeholders to know, the number of exceeds, how many times did we exceed the standards. So it is something that we propose that we should be able to communicate. Further than that, it is actually to pinpoint at what time of the year are we actually exceeding. And why? That is very important for us in terms of our intervention, in terms of our planning and support. So we are going into the detail. We have not shared that information in this platform, but it's information that in the IPT, in the MSRG, we do share and we actually discuss. Now, one thing that is evident, and I'm not trying to put blame or point fingers at a particular level, but it is very evident when we do the analysis that for most parts of the year, we are below the for most part. However, there comes a period where, for whatever reason, and people may want to say, well, the client unfortunately is the one particular fault. But the data is there, and we're not going to be disputing the data. It tells us that between these heroes of the day, between me and the terminal, we exceed terribly the minimum resources. But that's what the data tells us. And we are working there to find the solution. But we acknowledge that throughout the year, the levels are up, even though there's no incidence, the baseline is up. And I think Prof. Garrett talked to us. That's something we've not actually looked at. But even outside of the priority areas, in areas that should be specifically seen as background, we still experience accidents where there are some resources. It talks to the conditions in South Africa, the weather patterns. That also needs to be looked at. With regard to the question of improvement, basically, there is a thing that there is no improvement in the priority areas. I think we need to go back and look at the data again. I've indicated initially that we are of the view that we have seen some improvement, not only in the data itself, but also in the institutional readiness in terms of the municipalities and the capacity. I mean, the previous National Quality Officer used to say that prior to the 2010 legislation coming into effect, we had 5 people at the national office managing all the resources in the country. And his feeling was that if you could just have one person in the municipalities, whether it's district or local, doing their job, we have had an increase in capacity. I'm of the view that we have made progress in ensuring that we have people in those particular positions. Yes, there is new lighting that my colleague from Southland said, but that is the reality of the environment we work in right now. We endeavor to ensure that the outcomes are protected to the best of the ability. So I think if our colleagues can indicate to us and give us the indicators that will determine whether we are effective or not, we would like to look at those and engage with them. We do acknowledge that in some instances there is a fluctuation in emissions as the draft has presented. But as a department, we feel that we are doing the level best that we can. And if there are areas of improvement, we welcome those. And I think our colleagues are still up in our engagement in the private area. We have put that forward to say, please engage with us. How can we improve? The other one is said that there is no clear demonstration that air quality is a major concern of the department. The care priority areas that it appears that from our point of view,
chairman, we made the air quality presentation to Parliament as well. We gave statistics of where we were, where we are now, and there was a definite thing towards not a fantastic improvement, but at least a slight improvement, Chair.
Okay. Yes, I
one thing, you remember also in our presentation that we made to Parliament,
I think Dr. Tomato, the lab officer mentioned this new system also that the department is going to be using to address some of the concerns raised by Dr. Kane for us. And I think the other issue that you wanted us to address was where we engage with industry. So I think Romina will just talk to how they engage. But in terms of our engagement with Dr. Kane for us and see how we have those engagements, particularly around data as well, I think about a month or two ago. So we are talking to each other here. And I think it's an effort on our part as well to ensure that we are doing as much as we can to promote the improvement of the projects.
To add to the FNDG, in the priority areas, we have established what we call the implementation task force together with the multi-stakeholder reference groups. And the purpose for that really is for not only just us, the government, together with the industry, but also together with the communities and any interested and affected parties to sit together and to discuss the challenges that we have and propose ways of addressing them. So specifically to the industry are expected in those engagements to present their initial reduction plans, but also to indicate what is their compliance status with respect to their AEL conditions. And so everybody is held accountable in that particular process, and our colleagues from CR and other representatives do participate in those meetings. And what we advocate for as well is that we must be able to create an atmosphere of trust and transparency and openness that not only us as government know what the industry are doing, but also the other stakeholders are aware and pose questions. And I think our colleagues will attest to the fact that those discussions are quite robust, and those companies that you present are questioning on their practices, on their emission reduction plans, as well as their compliance status. So it is not only just between us and the industry affected, but it's open up to all the other interested in the sector.
How often does that function?
With respect to ICT, we have this meeting on a quarterly basis. And just to give the numbers, Chair, we have three priority areas, and on average, each priority area will have around three ICT. So it's quite different because of the three priority areas, we have three of the ICT in each. With respect to the MSRG, those happen at twice a year.
Have the cost been that the engage in fingerprinting exercise, those kind of forums when they meet, so they aren't very effective. But I guess we have to improve on that, because there has to be a platform where there is engagement between the department and the various stakeholders, particularly the affected industries. So that on a regular basis, there was the start chat meeting where you follow up on certain things that needs to be done, progress that has been made, especially in compliance with what needs to be compliant. Because the suggestion that in the priority area there shouldn't be postponement unless under exceptional circumstances. It's a sound proposal. Because what is the purpose of clearing an area, protected area, if you don't work towards making sure that you drastically reduce the levels of pollution in the affected area. So the issue of a forum, I think we must start the department to look into that and to make sure that you perfect that method of interaction between the department and the various stakeholders.
must be, you know, structured in such a way that you're able to make progress. You know what you're looking for, you get reports, and then you evaluate those reports, you decide on the next course of action. And you regularly report to us in Parliament as to how far you are doing that, whether you're succeeding or not. Because you see, both the CAR implementation and the CSIR, they don't contradict each other if you are looking at them. And basically what they are saying is that there is not much that can be shown for the exploration. And that's why there is a merit in the suggestion that the department seems to be taking, does not seem to be taking this point very seriously, this agenda of reducing air pollution. We might be doing things, but they may not be enough, so we have to increase on what we're doing. But as I said, we will have a discussion when we come back on the minimum emission standard. And please, the National Air Quality Officer must be here when we have that discussion. I did interact with Judy, but I thought they are still not here. About the explanation that I've given. I think this kind of meeting don't take place every day, so when you call here, you must prioritize us, especially the most important people in the department must come, because it's a responsibility to approve the postponement given to any individual. And that individual must hold him or her to account. It's our work as members of Parliament to do that. It also gives you that power, it also will make sure that you exercise the program. And for us to do that, we need the presence of the Jewish. She must come here. It's quite unfortunate that she's not here and we don't take the absence for the country. So next time she must come, a 2-day session that we're talking about, so that we can then look at each of those applications in relation to the broader objective of reducing the pollution in the, especially in the priority areas. I guess we've had robust engagement. One area which I almost forgot that has to be dealt with through an intergovernmental forum is the functioning of this monitoring station. I think the department together with all the spheres of government, the provinces, municipalities must sit down together and work through this. It is not far-fetched, you know, to get people employed either at the provincial level of government and secondly to the municipalities to perform this responsibility. If the municipalities do not have the resources to do that, but the metro should be having the resources to employ the people together with the district. But I know that the district is not any serious to the process. So there are various ways of attending to this thing of capacity. It can be that since the introduction of the Air Quality Act, we are still struggling on questions of capacity. We should have further stage. Because at the end of the day, we talk about the health of our people, which are protected in the Constitution. But those Constitutions require us to take certain steps to protect the environment and the health of the people. And but do it in practical terms. So I think we had a very good engagement today. Informative, but also very progressive in a sense that there are certain basic things that we all agree that there is some shortcoming. There is certain work that has been done, but from where we are sitting now, it does look like it's not enough. It's more than could be done. Otherwise, let me take this opportunity to thank the invited guests for your participation, sharing with us the information you have. I've just been here from 8:30 in the morning up to now, it's 4:15. Attentively listening to the input and so forth. So you've been such a very wonderful audience. And I'd like to thank you very much together with our presenters, the panel of experts. Next time we will start before lunch. And after lunch, we will schedule the discussion. We'll take the presentation in the morning and take it over for the afterwards discussion. But we value our attendance coming here. I know most of you are included to come to Cape Town. Some of you are here today. So as a portfolio committee, we'd like to thank you very much. We will be having another one just before December.
What are we going to talk about?
Climate financing. Climate financing. We're going to look at the effort of the instruments that are available to us in the county to finance mitigation strategies and adaptation strategies to combat climate change. So that's what I'm going to talk about. Some of you may attend, most of you will be outside your area of scope. But the necessary invitations are going to be issued. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Seven.